Okay, ready?
I think in an emergency period, they might be.
Okay, the meeting of House Labor and Commerce Committee is called to order at 1:40, February 26th. Members present are Representatives Kopanen, Boucher, Ellis, and Donley, and the first, and Representative Davidson. First matter of business for the committee today is confirmation hearing of Commissioner Tony Smith for the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. Commissioner Smith has already joined us here at the table. And Commissioner Smith, do you have any opening remarks you'd like to make?
No, not really, Mr. Chairman. I'm available to answer any questions which the committee may have.
Thank you. Representative Boucher.
I noticed both of you got a haircut. It must be moving toward the more conservative point of view. Not you.
I need one.
Unfortunately, I know.
Representative Boucher, it'd be a mistake to equate being clean cut with being conservative. So.
Thank you. Point well taken. That's a New England thing.
Representative Kopanen, did you have a question for Commissioner Smith?
I'm sure this is the wrong question. I noticed your wife's maiden name, right? She's related to Bechtel Incorporated.
I have that question.
The family all comes from the same place in Germany. It's the ones that are wildly financially successful continued on to Colorado with the mule train, and her family stopped in Ohio and started farming. So she's from the farming side of the Bechtel thing.
They weren't Amish, but I don't
know. No, they were from a community.
Representative Boucher has a serious question.
Boucher. Commissioner Smith, one of the things is, of course, we have great hopes. The governor has. He's pointing in a much larger area, and I think that generally the public and the legislature feel that there has to be diversification. But one of the immediate things that we feel could be done has been brought up a number of times. It came up on the legislation, I think Representative Ellis was probably, regarding the role that the airport could play and who is going to participate in doing it. Now, primarily, I view both sides of it because I'm in transportation. And the airlines were a little concerned that we didn't go charging into something that was going to drive shrink down the revenue so that they would end up actually subsidizing a thing because they feel that most of the profit comes from that. But at the same time, when I was talking to them, I said, but on the other hand, in the area of tourism, you do a, quote, cooperative marketing approach. And most of the state dollars right now in that cooperative marketing approach are going toward bringing Aunt Mabel from Indiana because, quote, that gets the biggest bang for the buck. And one of the problems that we ran through last year on the Senate side, after the House was pretty aggressive in promoting tourism on this side, but the Senate expressed a concern that there wasn't a more international flavor to it. So I brought up the point is maybe as we develop this within the airport that the very same people that are talking about cooperative marketing of tourism could be some of the brains, and you could take much the same approach of cooperative to international tourism and then economics. And I'm wondering, since both of these fall under you, if this, except for the airport, that's going to be done, and might it not be well for transportation and Department of Commerce to be doing it? Maybe you're doing it already.
I welcome the opportunity, Representative Boucher, to respond to that. It's very timely. About 3 weeks ago, the Vice President of JAL came to me and the Vice President of Alaska Airlines came up and discussed the whole marketing question for the Anchorage and Fairbanks Airport. At the same time, I had a number of discussions with Commissioner Gutierrez on DOT and the marketing aspect of it. So what I can report is that, and I should also mention that a number of carriers like Eric and people like that, they're very dependent on a viable airport, have contacted me and raised some of the concerns that you've indicated. So I leave tonight for Anchorage. Tomorrow's the Alaska Power Authority board meeting. I'm on that board, but at 7:30 tomorrow morning, I'll be meeting with Ren Bowman and the people from Anchorage to hear what they hope to do. In addition, I have proposed to JAL, to Alaska Airlines, a cooperative marketing program, much like tourism and ASME, where each the private sector and public sector puts money up. And Rocky, CPS, and I have come up with a sum of money and how it would proceed. And I've been told by ERA and JAL and Alaska and the carriers that it makes sense. On Monday morning, there'll be a meeting of myself, mostly either Riley Snell or Bob Poe from DOT, Bill McKay for Alaska Airlines, Kitamoto for JAL, Wally Hickel Jr. for the Cook, Jay Oxford for the Hilton, and the manager of the Sheraton, to discuss an actual industry government partnership to market that. That meeting will be the first discussion with the people who are in fact the players, because there is a legitimate concern. If you take a lot of money out of that airport fund, you increase landing rights, and that isn't going to increase the amount of people that come. We also have to remember that we have both the Fairbanks and the Anchorage airports, and we need to deal with both of those. So those discussions have started, but the first formal kind of flesh out the marketing concept will be Monday morning at 7:30. In addition, I have got a bill prepared which will be going over to the governor's office for a small business loan fund, $100,000 cap, which deals with the cottage industry and the tourism kind of thing that I think I've previously mentioned before this committee. And that's an effort to provide some reason for independent travelers, because that's the question of cruise ship versus independent travelers. And across the board, everyone says that it's necessary to have things for the independent travelers to do, and that there's a real problem with source of capital for the real small bed and breakfast lodge type of operation. I've talked to Ron Bosey and various executives of the financial institutions, and they tell me that what I'm talking about is in fact not the kind of project that they will finance. We're not talking about duplication. So that's in the works. I am also spending Friday afternoon and evening up in Big Lake with the statewide Convention and Visitors Bureau convention, or annual meeting, whatever it is, and then I will be attending a dinner with that group from around the state to again deal with this specific problem on a one-to-one basis. So your question is, I think, very appropriate, correctly focused, but I assure you that I'm personally taking a great interest in seeing if we have a bring to you something that makes sense.
Just one more quick one, and as related, I kind of think of things we can do now. I've been associated, in fact, amazing enough, I find out in my district, I have 57 small manufacturers. One guy makes 10 airplanes a year. Another, Kiana, is grossing now over $1 million, has opened up a 4,000 square foot factory in Dalton, where the people of Dalton manufacture hoodies and bring them in, and he's thinking of opening them up in other villages. So what they've banded together is a group of small manufacturers, and the smallest of them got two people employed, and they make cocktail mix, stuff like that. Some of them mom and pop operations out in the garage, but there are 1,800 of them. And they said if we could get some help and we each employed one more person, you put 1,800 people into the workforce. In other words, these are the entrepreneurs that think they can do something in Alaska themselves, and in the case of Kayana is obviously doing it. In fact, Kayana's problem is people are copying what he's doing. That's why they're so concerned with the Made in Alaska and sending it back here. In fact, they've gone to the point where, have you seen these Made in Alaska ads? They're doing that themselves. And I think that this matches perfectly with the Made in Alaska thing, and I think you could pull quite a coup if somehow or other they could be assisted or encouraged. And I've talked about subsidized, in other words, that you brought it, you know, kind of to focus. Right now we talk about the great big industries, fishery, this and that. But hey, there's evidently 1,800 people out there. That's what they claim their membership is ultimately going to be. And they're right, if you could add one person, they range from Matanuska being the biggest one. But then newspapers are manufacturers and et cetera. So, you know, I just wonder if it's going to be, is Bill Lee and the group contacted you?
My involvement with Mr. Lee was we did a story with, as you know, I had an involvement with the Alaska Business Monthly. He was, I think, the cover story on our second issue.
He was.
And so I'm very familiar with, and my wife's the president of the Alaska Business Monthly, so I'm very familiar with Mr. Lee. And I assure you, we are doing everything we can to, in fact, work with the small manufacturers. The Stanford Research Institute's symposium on the state planning agencies on how you create wealth, mm-hmm. indicates that nationwide 80% of the jobs come from small businesses, and I think that's definitely the case. In Alaska, it's skewed a little bit because of the impact of oil, but even considering that facet of the Alaska economy, we're darn close, and that's a focus of our economic development.
Just one final thought that I'm just so enthusiastic about, you know, if the entrepreneur is out there, well, what's he doing? He's making cocktail sauce. But that's cocktail sauce that's bought internally from products produced here. Now, here's a real success story, which I'm sure, Set Point, Alaska, Jack Jesse. They've opened offices in Houston and Dallas, and they are exporting one of the finest software programs in the country, and that started out of the brains of a handful of Alaskans, and they are already up in the multi-million dollars. And I was just wondering if somehow or other we can go high-tech to a degree, maybe focusing some of them as a success story, which us having more computers per capita in the state. Example, if the state set aside on its mainframe computer a compartment and created a toll-free call and told every kid out there that is hacking around with a computer that you can use this state's database to experiment on program development. But that anything that in utilizing that, that the state shares 50% of it. Amazingly enough, the
read
program,
only,
huh?
Read only.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But amazingly enough, the program that Jack Keyes is developing was done. You remember Eric Dahl up here, kid, lifelong Alaskan, an expert in artificial intelligence. And there's some great brains here, and I think out in rural Alaska, that there are some great brains if somehow or other you could create a state workshop for them. And it could be done after 7 in the evening when the systems are shut down. All it would require is to go to Alaskan, and maybe Alaskan would make a grant. You know, they've got 35 communities connected together in the state where you can dial a local number, what the satellite, and into it. Now, this is the type of thing that I think if other people saw this state using the empty spaces that we've got. And I think somebody like Jack Jesse would be extremely excited to work with you. In fact, he's going to be in town this evening. He's been trying to get by to see you.
I'd like to see him. Oh, he's a real success. Indian Valley Meats is another one. I mean, they're actually bringing product from the lower 48 to Alaska, smoking it, and sending it back to the lower 48. The Strategic Planning Commission of the State Chamber met, made a presentation to myself and to others in the administration last week, and they've identified computer software as an area of opportunity in the competitive world, and they've also identified the insurance area. And I'm meeting with Mary Willis, who was part of that group, on Monday in Anchorage to pursue where they feel the areas of opportunity are. And I assure you that those areas are out there, and we just need to tap them. And there's a lot of great noodle power coming out of the private sector that if we listen to them, I think we're going to see some real economic development. The quality of the State Chamber Strategic Planning Commission and the ideas that they were throwing on the table for us, we got a lot more than if we had hired a lot of consultants to do the same thing. They're enthusiastic.
I just finished with one thought to stimulate you on that. We all tend to get excited when Nakasone and the president of these companies, and we meet them in the Alaskan, and here's some grungy little Alaskan, you know, knocking on the door, trying to get an appointment. And I think I've often thought I would have, if I had the power, I'd have a department of the future, where the brainstormers and the so-called far-outers of the state would have an opportunity to at least get their wild thoughts. And I think that something along that, you know, a giant mind suggestion box, deposited in there, I'll just bet your bottom dollar 12 months won't go by that something that creates employment for at least 100 people wouldn't come out of it. You know, we keep thinking of digging more oil wells and stuff like that, and you know, from our association where I'm coming from, but I think that if your department created the attitude that it was going to look inward before it looked outward, you'll ought to get some amazing results that don't cost an awful lot of money. And I promise you I won't say any more.
You don't have to promise.
I've been trying to get him in his office to tell him this. The last time I was in his house at dinner, and I promised I wouldn't talk politics. I apologize.
No, it's okay. Representative Ellison, Representative Coleman.
This committee yesterday considered for the second time and passed out to the Resources Committee my bill relating to aquatic farming, House Bill 108. And, you know, the most controversial aspect, well, the only controversial aspect of the legislation relates to pen rearing of salmon, allowing that to, clearing up the statutes to allow that to happen. And one thing that the fishermen who feel threatened, feel their markets would be threatened by this new Alaskan product, kept just over and over referring to the study that Governor Sheffield, some people felt that Governor Sheffield had promised. He convened a working group and they came out with some recommendations, but I guess everyone would agree it was an election year and people wanted to tread lightly and not step on any toes. And the money, I understand now, for that study of the socioeconomic and environmental impacts of pen rearing of salmon, that the money's to be that study or tied up in $163 million, the capital projects for fiscal year 87 that the House will be debating and the entire legislature will be considering. Can you just tell me whether you think it's necessary to go ahead with that study? The fishermen say that they have been talking to the state government the last several years as this issue's been raised, and they won't buy into the whole idea of this new industry taking hold in Alaska. And we know, you know, the political clout that the fishing industry carries, that they won't buy into it until this study has been done, and we can prove to them that there's no negative economic impact on their industry at all. So what's your outlook on all that? Will the study get done if the money's released? Do you think we need to do the study? Or?
Representative Ellis, we are presently meeting in the fisheries mini cabin, and one of the principal issues is the administration's position on agriculture. And I understand from Commissioner Collins, but the 3.5-hour meeting last week was the longest meeting in the history of the mini cabin, and we are going to be back in session, I believe, next week, and we have each one of the agencies or departments that's involved has got appointed staff that are working on very, in some instances, a full-time basis on developing the position, so that the administration is not ready, unfortunately, to take a position on American Indian. My own personal view is that the industry has left the starting gate, and it's my understanding, for instance, the Norwegians are to the point where they have seven different colors of salmon, so that the restaurant can not only pick the size, and the type, but they can pick the color. Canada has had experienced some problems, but they're going full speed ahead. And the important thing is that we deal with this emerging industry in the manner that Alaskans are the beneficiaries, and that Alaska's market share for fish products is not lost to the Norwegians or the Danes or any other, the Canadians or any other groups. I hope that we will have an administration position in the very near future. I do think that it's been unfortunate in the state that sometimes we've spent more time and effort in fish gear politics fighting each other and then lost market share to other countries. And I can assure you that from my own personal perspective, my goal is to see a real Alaskan fishery, and that includes all the different segments of the industry.
So going ahead, if I may continue, Mr. Chairman, so going ahead with the study and those monies that are there, the capital budget moves through, that's part of your discussions?
It is. The study and the Penrare salmon question, there are a number of issues that I think will have to be considered in the regulatory process as to how you do different aspects of mariculture. But I think from what I can see personally, the industry is moving. And if we spend another couple of years studying it, it'll move without Alaskans, and then we'll be in the position of wondering why we are no longer able to penetrate the market, and we'll feel that somehow we have been slighted. I think it'll be in many ways our own fault. I think we have to step up to the starting block, and we have to realize that a lot of the horses have left the gate doing quite well.
Well, I think we share the same concerns on this. I appreciate the time you're putting into it, because it could be something that you all could decide to ignore and not move on. I'm glad to hear that you're taking the lead.
I assure you, we will not be ignored.
Thank you.
Representative Copeland? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually following up on that other point. One of the problems that many of the fishermen, I'd say the Prince William Sound people especially, they have a fisherman's cooperative. And that was incorporated under federal law. But there seems to be the feeling that, you know, a mom-and-pop operation in 10 salmon is not feasible unless subsidized the way the Norwegians got their thing off the ground. And there's objection to the corporate structure, precisely because the participation of the members would not be there if the corporation was controlled by the management. There would, at least among the Prince William Sound fishermen, there seems to be some feeling this may be feasible if they could all take part in the decision-making through a co-op. We are looking at a bill that was drawn up by legal affairs and also by the, to incorporate cooperatives. In other words, it takes a model act and because we have the corporation code, which is out of date, as you know. We have the section on profit-making corporations, which is now stalled and not in. We have this bill on co-ops, and we have a possible bill on non-profit. We would like to feel that this is a something that does concern the Labor and Commerce Committee. And what would be your feeling if we made the first one of those bills, the co-op code, so that we would have in Alaska statute something other than telephone cooperatives?
I have no problem, and I think you focused on a very real problem. And it's my understanding from my staff that a turnkey pen-reared facility at this point in time is about $1 million for mowing. So we're talking about a pretty sizable investment. So I would certainly encourage you to do so. And please just, we would be glad to comment on it and take a look at whatever you come up with.
The other point, which is, I guess, a bitter point for some of the fishermen, I guess we've turned over some of the AIDA loans, fishing loans to, some of the fishing loans over to AIDA, so they pay to AIDA, but because of the direction of AIDA, they kind of borrow. This is the Aquaculture Association. AID is specifically limited loan to profit-making corporations.
Yes.
And they were wondering if they set up these co-ops, whether AIDA statutes might not be changed to allow loans to fiscally stable cooperatives and nonprofits.
Well, the AIDA's loan policy, and I'm chairman of AIDA, but in 30 days I don't have a full handle on it, but my understanding is that the definition of for-profit doesn't preclude a co-op. In other words, I think some of these groups may not understand what AIDA is not.
Bertie Wagner, a few years ago, when asked in this committee about that, did say that it did. Couldn't understand how they would make a profit, which I think is a dumb statement by a guy who runs an operations side as an AIDA. But he did make that statement to us.
Well, as the new chairman of AIDA, my understanding of our parameters is that we do not make investments or loans to companies or individuals that are precluded from by the tax laws or some other statute from not being profitable. Essentially, they're not allowed to be a profitable entity. But for instance, a co-op, which can be very profitable, it's just a function of what you do with the profits. My understanding is not precluded. And I've read the statutory language in AIDA, and if it's being interpreted differently, I'll ask for an opinion of AIDA's counsel and take a look at it. That's not my understanding.
Be in a position to pay that. The other, we heard a discussion from the UConn delegation, and they said that one of their strategies for increasing local hire and local employment was to redesign buildings so that they would be essentially stick-built from local materials. And they had developed what they felt met their constitutional challenge, which is very much the same as ours, by having a value-added requirement. The certain percentage of value added, and I know that here of Alaska Window would just love that if that was part of the building contract. Could you look into the possibility of such a value added, which would help the Alaska Manufacturers Association considerably? That would be very useful to us.
Definitely, we'd be glad to. And we are looking at, in that vein, the specifications throughout Alaska provide and require Douglas fir, which of course is not an Alaska product. The Saya Shops shop has been working on this particular issue, and the tests indicate that Sitka spruce and Alaska birch has all the same strength qualities as Douglas fir, yet out of habit more than anything else, every building that we can find in the state of Alaska specifies you can't use local products. You got to go out to Douglas fir. We are presently working to try to change that, and that's what the governor was referring to when he talked about import substitution. We certainly will expand that to look at the value-added side in other areas.
The other is that if you have any ideas about the structure of the department, one of the problems always with state government is territoriality and turf and the need for cooperation and communication on something on a regional level or on a level of a common problem. For example, I usually use child care, which requires community regional affairs, oftentimes Department of Education and Health and Social Services, and sometimes even public safety to work on the same thing. So I don't see that we're ever going to find the ideal organization where you're always going to be able to go to one agency. But I see you are working with Commissioner Contreras on that particular problem. Are you going to be looking at ways in which people working in your department can work with their counterparts, let us say, in the Department of Natural Resources, where some of the people seem to think they're working for Commerce anyway?
Well, we are working, the advocates are working with DNR, but I think a perfect example is that Commissioner Hoffman and I have set up a situation where there's a new memorandum of agreement between Commerce and DCRA, and it's our intention that the Office of Enterprise in Commerce will interface with the people that Commissioner Hoffman has out in the field. And Commissioner Hoffman has loan officers and development and community specialists in various areas in the state, and we are presently taking the Department of Commerce's programs by memorandum agreement. Larry McCulloch, new director of the Division of Enterprise, has already been working with the people in Commissioner Hoffman's department who are running that show, and we can do an awful lot of loan packaging and business advice through his loan officers that are already out there. And I'm kind of amazed. I assure you, as a commissioner, I am not at all interested in turf battles. I came down to try to do a job, and I don't see any need for the state to pay double, and Commissioner Hoffman's got a whole bunch of people that have a great deal of expertise, and we're going to work with them. And recognizing the nature of government, we'll do formal memorandums of understanding so everybody understands what the deal is. But I assure you, we are going to work together and see that turf battles don't preclude the people of the state of Alaska from getting the government services they need.
Excellent. I can only encourage you to continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, not Jake, going back to agriculture, if I may, for a couple of comments. And I know in my office we're getting a lot of concern both ways. Some who want to proceed rapidly and try to catch some of those horses, and others who are still wondering if, in fact, the race is smart to get into. So there are problems and arguments of displacement, both in siting as well as market. There are environmental concerns, there's lifestyle change pressures. And some who think that it becomes an extension of the colonial yoke of fisheries whereby processing has been concentrated from many instances from outside Alaska, and we see that presently with our marketing situation. And then it brings us to the point of considering the shell fishery and the pinbird salmon. Do you foresee any possibility of, in the near future, of maybe taking this mariculture effort and splitting off the two, the shellfish or the plant aquaculture and the pinbird salmon?
Well, that was the previous administration's position. We are working on, as I said, with the mini cabinet, determining what the administration policy will be. I personally, speaking for myself, Tony Smith, I personally feel that the issue should be handled at the administrative basis as a result of amassing facts and looking at the problem where everybody has a chance to have input, and that it does not, in my view, make sense to split off the salmon issue from the shellfish issue. I don't know what the administration's final viewpoint, because there may be other people that are involved in this issue that feel differently than I do. I do think that the questions that you present need to be resolved, including who controls what happens, and that they need to be resolved where all the conflicting interests have an opportunity to be heard and to be considered on the record and decisions made with the normal processes that are carried out in the administrative procedure. That's why I feel that if the legislature set the overall parameters, but then at the administrative level, we can deal with waste issues and things of this nature, and some of the biological and disease issues that are there and they need to be dealt with.
Well, can, in that same regard, then, or along that same line of thinking, do you think it would be wise, rather than open up the entire state, that we set all geographic limits? If there is a particularly strong desire in one geographic region of the state to proceed as rapidly as possible with green-river salmon, that go for it? Or do you feel that that would also maybe be a wise approach?
I haven't thought of that. I've certainly, that's an issue that I've certainly, certainly consider I guess it, then what you're suggesting is a local option.
Yeah.
I haven't considered it.
I know presently, if I may, Mr. Chairman, on Kodiak Island, there's already been a lot of staking sites. And of course, it's the long process of permit issuance that creates some of the big problems. So when we say that no one is going to get a speculator's head start. In fact, I think that fact already happened. So I spoke with the office of the development office of Kodiak yesterday. There have been several sites that have their own permit process that have been started. So there is that concern as well. I guess, and then if I may, one more question, Mr. Chairman. Since this is a confirmation hearing, I would just like to know why in the world you want a job like this.
I guess I see. I asked myself that. I believe in Governor Cooper. I think we have the right leader for the right time. And I think that that when you have a lot of money, the political process really, by its nature, in a democracy, tends to pass that money out in some manner. And that's what it does. We did very well to preserve as much as we have of the fund. I think that this is, we have probably a 2-year window when our belts are tightened, when we can make some changes in the direction of the state. And in fact, not just from the rhetoric side, but the real side, do some diversification. And I guess when I looked at it, it's a democracy. All of you have taken you've sacrificed certain things in your lives to come down here as legislators. I felt that there was a time when something could be done. We had the right leader, Governor Cooper, who would deal with the merits and step up to the line. And was there a time when he could make some changes?
Commissioner Smith, I have two real quick questions. And just real brief answers would be appreciated because we're running behind time. Has there been a decision made within the Division of Insurance to retain the records regarding the consumer complaints?
I have talked to the Anchorage staff about that. We were looking at an NAIC model form that's used for that, and we haven't started, but we're working toward that with the idea that we use the standard national model.
Okay, thank you. And my second question, does the department or the division have a position on mandatory auto insurance? You support it, oppose it, support it, if we can find the money, what's the position?
I talked to Mr. Evans in the governor's office, and we're in the process of looking at that. I believe we're going to support it, Mr. Chairman, but I'd want to verify that with the governor's office before I went on the record.
Thank you.
I get one quick, if I may.
Sure. So,
I'm excited about being here. I think that, after knowing the wrong time, it is a real opportunity for ideas, fallout ideas, and ideas in the future to find a home. And that's why I kind of recommend, in fact, I envision a Commission 2000 within the department that could pick the brains of all levels in the state. And I know there are people out there that would like to participate. But one thing, and a very basic thing, the problem we're having now is databases, and I would appreciate whoever in your department handles it, if you could give me a listing of the databases that you have access to within the Department of Commerce, that would be the name of the information, a catalog of all databases that are under your control. Then secondly, a listing of the hardware and the software that is under your control and within your budget there. We're having a tough time getting that from the department. It's just what we are doing is each one of them. We see something over here that's being done over here, and we're trying to be constructive in seeing that information is connected so we can run more efficiently.
Representative Boucher, Ms. Kelly Haggard, you may know, has joined me. This is her third day as Assistant Commissioner for Economic Development. She's worked with Chilista, as I think some of you may know. Chris has done 60 community plans and worked on database before, has a master's from Berkeley. Karen Mathis in the Anchorage office has a master's from MIT, and Trickman Hayes has also done some of this. Kelly is in charge. She is working on that. I will have her call you, and she will be glad to work with whatever concerns and see if we can get a rational database for the state.
Okay. Representative Furness has joined us. Representative Copeland?
Yeah, if there's no further discussion, I would like to move the letter of confirmation with individual recommendation.
Without objection, the motion passes.
Where do I sign?
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Pass the letter around.
Okay. And don't let politicians get you down. Just got nothing to do with the real world.
Got a great deal to do with it, or else screw it up thoroughly.
The next matter before the committee today is House Bill 88 from the, by Rules Committee by request of the Governor, Linda O'Bannon. This is a private individuals to bring suits to enforce the current consumer protection laws and unfair trade practices laws. Ms. O'Bannon, would you like to give us a brief, identify yourself and say who you represent?
I'm Linda O'Bannon. I'm in the Attorney General's Office and head of the Consumer Protection Section. business is a private cause of action for economic injury as a result of the unfair and deceptive acts and practices of their competitors. Right now, under Alaska's Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act, private citizens have a private cause of action for consumer injury to themselves, but businesses do not have that private cause of action. So this would allow a business, for instance, if there were a local furniture store established, had been in business for a long time, a fly-by-night operator came in and started doing deceptive advertising, conducting bait and switch types of sales practices, and other practices that are unlawful under Alaska's Unfair Trade Practices Act. A business competitor who was harmed economically could bring an action for that injury and recover damages for the actual damages they could prove were a result of that unfair or unlawful activity by their competitor. In addition, it says, in all cases, the court may provide equitable relief it considers necessary or proper. This would allow a court, for instance, to order the violator to stop an illegal practice, essentially issue an injunction against that violator. And we supported this long before there was the proposal to cut the funding for consumer protection, but certainly if that occurs, then this would at least be one avenue for private prosecution of the Alaska Supreme Court trade laws.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee? From the panel? There's anybody else?
If you give me some latitude, not on the bill, can you bring us up today? What is your current status? You're zeroed out of the budget, your
that's
division?
True.
Any discussion on that? Representative Copeland.
I move that we pass House Bill number 88, the next committee referral, individual recommendation.
Any objections? Hearing no objections, motion is passed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next matter before the committee is House Bill 46. You'll find a proposed committee substitute in your packets. Rather extensive combination of several proposals currently.
Hold on, I'll take quickly.
Sherry Copeland, Representative Sun's office, would you please join us here at the table?
Mr. Chairman, may I be get ready for telecommunications? Do you want to name them?
Representative Burnson's here, we're okay. Thank you.
Cool. Well, appreciate it. Can I ask one question? How did a two-page bill get so heavy?
Our office is known for it.
We take an 88 or the 46.
I have cohorts I'm going to call them.
Well, please, let's bring all the cohorts up. If we need them to understand what's going on here.
Two pages have become 30. I believe there must be some slight changes.
The chair's intent today with this piece of legislation is to merely get the committee substitute before us so that when people talk about it, they'll know that we do have a proposed committee substitute.
May I, for the purposes of discussion, move that we have CS for House Bill 46, Labor and Commerce, as the bill before the committee for the purposes of discussion.
Thanks. Any objections? Hearing none, committee substitute is before the committee for discussion. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Dolly. Thank you, members of the committee. What we've done with this bill is taken four bills and combined it into one, and I guess we're calling it the insurance omnibus bill of sorts. We had House Bill 71, which was Representative Sun's bill, as introduced a few weeks ago. House Bill 46, which was Representative Navarro's bill, and then we had two proposed governor's bills that were never introduced, and we took those and wound those into this. A lot of it's housekeeping. I say most of the governor's bills, most portions of the governor's bills that are in this omnibus bill are housekeeping measures. But we've taken parts of 71, parts of 46, and we've made 46 the vehicle. So that's why we've got a 30-page bill in front of you. Okay. I don't know how far you can go explaining what the bill does. I can only address those portions of the bill that Representative Sun first sponsored. I would not feel comfortable representing other parts of the bill.
That's fine. That's a start.
Okay. Our concern, do you want me to start with that?
Please.
71 did? Okay. Well,
tell us about what parts of 71 made it into this.
Okay. It's toward the tail end. We start, and I will also apologize, I have not gotten this monster until today. First time I put my eyes on it, so I apologize for that.
46.
One thing that is, was both in 46 and 71, and was an administration bill or department bill last year, is, do you remember the broker's agent thing? It's too close to the front. Page 8. Page 8. Really? Yeah. We will have a sexual
table
to you. Patent below, and she's probably doing this up here soon. Patent below, we're doing the bar. We've got Don Koch and John George from insurance and Jeff Bush from the AG's office. Okay. Section 14 and 15 are trying to take care of a problem in which you have an independent broker who receives an insurance premium, and please correct me if I'm incorrect here, who's received an insurance premium, and because he's not an agent of the insurance company, he is not now in statute required to pass that on to the insurance company necessarily. There's no provision in which he's mandated to do that. If he does not, in fact, pass it on to the insurance company, and the insured who came to get that insurance doesn't realize that, he's basically uncovered. So you go to place a claim, and the insurance company has no record of having received that payment. There's no coverage there. And I'm probably not describing it as well as Don and John could. But what we're trying to address here is only in the case of premium payments, in no other case.
This is section 14 here.
We're in section 14, correct.
And 15.
And 15. Only in the case of premium payments will the broker be considered an agent. By that I mean when a premium payment is made to the broker, it is considered being paid to the insurance company. Now, I'll be corrected on how badly I stated
that. Mr. George, okay, we even this latest 5 minutes ago, were having an argument in the back row as to what we were trying to fix, as to which problem we were trying to fix, and then deciding whether this language did it. Originally, the concept, and this comes out of the governor's bill of a couple of years ago, we've had situations where a licensee is both an agent and a broker, has two licenses, and may represent companies as an agent, and may also represent the insured as the insured's agent. So you go into your insurance person's office and you buy coverage, but you don't know whether he's acting as the insurance company's agent or if he's acting as your agent to go out and find insurance. It only makes a difference when the broker goes insolvent and you find out, well, you've got your canceled check, the broker got your money, but an insurance company did not. There was coverage placed. The insurance company acknowledges they've issued the policy that we didn't get paid. We're canceling your policy for non-payment. And you come in and say, I've got my canceled check. We're saying, in that case, because the company has designated the broker as the person to collect the money for them, that there is coverage in effect, and the company's on it. They knew they wrote it, they just didn't get paid for it. Another view of that, and maybe I'll let Jeff explain this, but maybe I can't, is that a broker might get the money and then not go out and try and place the business or be unable to place it. And I think some would say that there should be coverage once the guy pays for it, even though it was not actually placed. And I think our version of this is the coverage had to actually be placed but not paid for. So, okay. Your turn.
My turn. This is what we're having. We've all just recently seen this bill. I, in fact, probably later than anyone, I saw it about half an hour ago first. And but the problem that comes out of this particular language, and this section may need a little bit of work and probably will need some work, is that what is also trying to be done with this particular language is the 15 days on page 9, subsection D, where it says a broker shall within 15 days after receiving a premium payment provide written coverage, confirmation of the insurance coverage. It's to require the broker to get the coverage placed within 15 days. Now, what we were having a debate was, what happens if the broker, within the 15 days, writes you a letter and says, you have been placed with INA, but in fact never contacted INA and INA didn't know that. What then happens? Is INA the insurer on that? And we were having a difference of opinion. I was saying that I don't think that would be interpreted to bind INA. They can't be bound when they haven't ever had notice. But and we may need to work on the language. What the attempt was is merely to require a broker to act within a certain reasonable amount of time once he collects your premium. And
there's another piece to that, if I may. And that that is sometimes it's just not possible for a broker who may have collected a down payment or a premium to place in 15 days. And if you've got a broker, and this is some of the ones we're concerned with, who's playing some things a little shaky, this could get real hazy as to who's responsible for providing that coverage to that insurer who has given a down payment. Because part of the language in this also says that the insurer is entitled to coverage if certain things occur. And as far as he's concerned, certain things have occurred. The broker can't provide coverage as such. He can secure coverage by going to somebody who does provide it. But he can't be the actual person who is making the coverage, although there have been cases where that's happened. I guess there's a Supreme Court decision. But that's... we're trying to mix two issues at once here, and I think there may be other ways to do it. And I think we can come up with language that will probably just I'm convinced it doesn't do it right now. That's what I definitely have.
As confusing as this all sounds, though, we aren't really in disagreement as to fixing it. It's not a policy disagreement. It's a matter of we aren't sure what the wording is.
It's the language. This is the first shot.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to say here is we've got the governor's office working with two legislators trying to roll a bunch of bills together into one. We've got a proposed committee substitute. We've got it before the committee now. It's been adopted by the committee for discussion. I'd like you all to go back and do an analysis of what you ended up with here. And make suggestions, and if we could get them in writing so the committee members could follow them the next time we bring the bill up, it'd be real helpful, and work with the committee staff, and then we'll work off of this from now on, this document before us, and that way we'll be able to make sense. And then at some point in time, we'll spend 3 hours and we'll go through it line by line. And
if it would help you at all, preliminary to that, I've had the bill since 9:30 this morning, so I'm ahead of most of the folks here. And I went through, and for my own benefit, I've color-coded the sections so I can tell what concept was covered by what sections. I can relate to you which sections deal with a particular concept, but that would be helpful to you.
Yeah, sure. I'd like to hear that.
there's an issue on general agents and managers that we've had a problem with. It's primarily a house cleaning issue. It is dealt with in sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill. Intended to clarify the distinction about who is a licensable general agent. Right now, the statute refers to general agent and manager, and there's always a confusion as to which is which because they do things so similarly. So we're questioning that.
We can print this and have it available to the committee like tomorrow morning.
First, you have a question.
I had noted that too, Mr. Chairman. I don't feel bad for being in the office for marking this deal up after I discovered it was 30 pages. So, since we had a chance to do it either. But basically, what is the difference between that general agent and manager?
Okay. That, until this point, has not been clear. That's been the problem. We have held that a manager is, at least in this context, is somebody who has a direct financial interest in the company. Either wholly owns the company that he's managing for. He is wholly owned by the company he is managing, or he is owned by the holding company who owns the insurance company that he's managing. If he's one of those, then we would consider him a manager. Anything else is a licensable general agent. That's basically what it's doing. And primarily that language is on the bottom of page that says who would have been the old manager of the world.
Okay, keep that in mind, when we set a line of authority, who has the most authority in this situation, the general agent or the manager?
They're pretty much the same from what we can see. It's just that the financial relationship is different.
Does both require to be licensed?
We will only be licensed the general agents here, not the managers.
So managers will be considered the company. They do it, it's the company doing it.
They've got a direct financial relationship.
Cool. So basically, you're dropping the designation of manager. Okay, all right. And making that the manager now is a company, the general agent is a licensed person, licensed to do business. Okay.
It sounds clean. Yes, sir. That's what
okay.
It is.
All right. I think you're one and two.
Okay. The next component is what we would call going to a continuous license. And it is dealt with,
almost everywhere.
Section, as far as I can see, section 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, 12, 13, 16, 17, 22, 24, 26, 27, 28, 29,
I see the rest of the
and 41. No,
quite, but 41. Before we go there, let me, if I could ask Mr. Chairman, ask a question here. Having to do with Section 3, I was a little confused. I'll draw your attention to line 17. Within this section, a person employed on salary by an insurer, including officers, and salaried employees performing the same services as a general agent, are considered to be service representative and are not required to be licensed. I don't understand that particularly. I'm jumping to when you look at page 7 in licensing of the firm.
Different firm, sir.
That's a different section. Okay, all right. But then,
just to clarify that for you, a person that's described there is really an employee of the insurance company who may, because of the way that insurance company works, be doing precisely the same thing as a general agent who is not under control or whatever by the insurance company, doing under his license, based by contract.
Yeah, it's my concern here. I don't have any problems with a salaried employee, but when you include officers.
Officers of that company, insurance company.
Right, I'm thinking the corporate officers of the company. Are we talking corporate officers, I would assume?
Yes, sir.
Of the company?
Of the insurance company.
Of the insurance company. Granted, you've got a general agent that is licensed. You've got corporate officers who would take on the same responsibilities and act the same under that agency license. And then, although these people are not required to be licensed, I'm looking down the road. Dick Randolph is a good example as a legislator who may have left his practice in the hands of an officer of the corporation. Where he would be off premise.
Okay. The claim. Dick Randolph is an insurance agent. This is nice. And he's covered under a different section of law, chapter of law, chapter 27. This is dealing in a section that deals with insurance company officers, not agency officers.
Yeah, but I think the thing still applies here, though. Let's see. Brent, I don't really think about insurance.
We can assure you that there is a distinction between Dick Randolph as an officer of
Who has employees
and do certain things versus the employees of an insurance company direct in terms of their manager, their officers. I'll use INA again.
Okay.
The officer of INA who goes out and is actually in the field soliciting business is a direct employee of the company.
Okay.
You know, he's an officer of the company, a direct employee. And any of his actions are going to be, we're going to hold the company accountable for anything he does.
So he does not have to be individually licensed.
However, if he were out there soliciting business for Blackman's Fund, he would have to be. Then he's operating for somebody.
I can see that if we're going to dive into the questions instead of just hear from what the sections are about, we could be here for another 3 hours. We've got one more piece of business I'd like to get before the committee today. Can you do it real quick?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
The next issue is a firm versus individual license. This is an efficiency and accountability issue. It's dealt with in sections 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 23, 25, part of 44, and part of 46. Part of 44 is subsection within the ring of 11. Do you want a brief statement as to what the issue is on the advantage, say, accountability or efficiency? Right now, we license a firm, agent, broker. We license individual adjusters. We also license individual agents or brokers who are not in the firm. The problem is that we want accountability on the individuals who are in the firm. What we intend with this is to license them and to no longer name each one of them on the firm's license. We end up with a real problem with efficiency when you've got a company that every other day is changing somebody on their firm license and they're adding and subtracting these things all the time. It's crazy. If we just license that person, we're done. In the case of adjusters, we do not currently license adjusting firms. So you can get individual accountability, but you can't get firm accountability when that firm is telling somebody to do something. And we've had a good case of that recently, which we managed to stipulate. So this gets a good handle on a couple of issues. The next one is the commercial cancellation limitation. It is dealt with in sections 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, I could have done 38, 40, and 46. This is a public protection issue. deals with commercial cancellation. It's quite typical of things we're seeing in other states with one exception, and that is ours has a provision that requires that if a policy is canceled, the insurance company has to return the unearned portion of premium back to that insured before the cancellation takes effect. No other state does that. We think that it's a good idea. Companies we've talked to are not overly disturbed. The next issue is actually a combination of things. A broker as agent, that we were talking about earlier. Also, some financial requirements on agents and brokers and dealing with their fiduciary and trust accounts. That's dealt with in sections 14, 15, 18, 19, 20, and 21. And that is an area where we have a number of recommendations to make as to some things that we've done that don't quite hit right. We'll be prepared with recommendations, specific recommendations. The next one is a change in the broker bond from a broker bond of $5,000 to $50,000. That's dealt with in section 13. The next is the change of cancellation to a pro rata cancellation for everything. At least that was the concept. We think that there are some improvements needed in the language there. That is in section 39. The next is the repeal of a number of obsolete sections in the law, and that's dealt with in section 46. The next piece, or next thing, is one dealing with alien trust, and in our view, this is probably the most critical issue that we've got to deal with. It is in section 30. And that one is a real problem. I don't know why it catches me. The next piece is adding nurses and nurse midwives to coverage under the Medical Indemnity Corporation of Alaska. That's in sections 42 and 43. And then the last sections, or the last issue rather, is the shifting of a number of definitions, primarily those in the license section, to the general section of the code, chapter 90. And that's in sections 44, 45, and 46.
Thank you. So as soon as we have a sectional analysis prepared and we hammer out some of these other local issues that you'd like to see, the sponsors and the governor's office would like to see corrected, we'll bring this bill back up and that'll give the committee members plenty of time to examine. Thank you very much. Senator Ziegler, do you have a statement you want to
make? Mr. Chairman, I can do it from here if I may, sir.
That'd be fine. I think the microphone will pick it up.
For the record, my name is Bob Ziegler, and I represent the independent insurance agents and brokers. You may remember, Mr. Chairman, when you were regrettably absent from town last Monday, my troops were here in town and they circulated and saw a lot of people. And during the course of their peregrinations, they indicated that they didn't really have too much objection to the two bills before us as we started out today, 46 and 71. And so they don't want you to think that they're welshing or crawfishing on what they may have told some of the legislators. They're merely saying we'd like to take a look at what we've got before us now and come in the back door with any suggestions. And therefore, sir, may I ask you if it would be appropriate for me to advise my clients to correspond directly with you and your committee members with any comments they may have concerning the work draft before us today?
That's one of the reasons we wanted to bring this up today, is to get the work draft officially before the committee so we can deal with it.
If that would be satisfactory, Mr. Chairman, then may I ask you one further question. That is, by when would you like to have this information in hand?
Probably before the end of next week.
End of next week? Shall be done. Thank you very much.
Yes, just not right now, but when the material comes back, I'd also like to have information on the surplus and capital requirements, especially for the trust funds of Lloyd's and similar groups, how these are maintained and which ones are in existence now.
All right. Any further comments from members of the committee on this piece of legislation? Thank you. Next bill before us is House Bill 45. There's a proposed committee substitute in your packets. The intent of the chair today is to merely make some changes, get the committee's approval on some changes to the committee substitute, and adopt the committee substitute, and then bring it up at a later time for another hearing. The bills have areas marked on them?
No. Only yours.
Right.
Also, Mr. Chairman has a question that they want to hear before you.
Yes. have a question you want to?
Yes, sir, I do. My name is Mark Turner. I represent Blue Cross of Washington in Alaska. My question is on page 2, section 3, D5, which states, submits a bid for goods or services under the name that appears on a person's current Alaska business license. Now, my company, Blue Cross of Washington in Alaska, has a number of subsidiary companies that are totally owned. They do not have external boards of directors, but are a wholly owned subsidiary of the parent corporation. Would we, under this legislation, have to get business licenses for these wholly owned subsidiaries? Or in our bidding process, would it be simpler to say the Goomba Corporation, wholly owned subsidiary of Blue Cross of Washington in Alaska, is my question for the committee.
I'm going to refer that question to the Attorney General's Office and Department of Commerce because they have the licensing, and I would like to know just what their current licensing policies are towards those type of subsidiaries that are doing business in Alaska, whether they simply register with Alaska business.
Well, currently, as I understand it, we are marketing a product that is for States West, but we market it as States West. But it's no secret that it's a Blue Cross corporation. So, you know, it's just a matter, do we need to go get another license?
All right, would you do,
I suppose we have
Chair
the capacity
Haberling,
to do that.
Could you pose your question in writing?
Sure.
And then we'll have staff submit that, and we'll have the answer by the next time we have the bill up.
Okay. Very good.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Good. Now, of the proposed committee substitutes, before the committee, on the last page, there's some this language that we had discussed during the last meeting on this. We have to like to make some kind of decisions today, whether or not to take some action on this proposed alternative languages. The first one on page 2, beginning at line 24, it's identified in subsection 3. The proposal here is to insert into present language the words staffed by the bidder or employee of the bidder. That was recommendation by the Attorney General's office?
No, that's just consistent with language in the existing state procurement code.
Okay, it's consistent with language in the existing state procurement code. That excludes those corporations that would simply have post office boxes in Alaska as their address. They would actually have to have a physical office in Alaska where they had a person in that office. I'd entertain a motion to adopt that into the committee substitute.
So moved.
Any objections? No objections. It's adopted. The next item on the alternative language page 3 was a recommendation by Representative Furness.
That's it exists in the statute now, but we have omitted it from the deleted it of the bill. The recommendation was to simply keep it in statute.
The alternative language, page 3, in the alternative language, the line item starts at line 2, actually, on this page. Page 2, line 18, and a new paragraph 5. Incorporated or qualified new business under the laws of the state, as a sole proprietorship, and if the proprietorship is a resident in the state or it's a partnership, and all partners are residents in the state, and the following 6, a joint venture. Mm-hmm. Ernest, do you want to move that?
I'll also vote, Mr. Chairman, as you have this consent.
Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, we'll adopt that in the substitute. The chair would like to delete. This was, we had a problem over legal drafting. Apparently the person who had worked on this before took a vacation or had to do something else, and then we were working with some new drafter. And we don't know how this section 5 that appears in the committee substitute got in there. If there's any members of the committee had any involvement with that section?
No, but I read it, Mr. Chairman, and it really does make sense. It ties into the site of 363100. What it appears to me is 363100 has to do with a nonprofit organization who offers a employment program, and this ties into it, and then it gives them a 10% edge at getting a contract. So, you know, it's sort of a job section. I'm not sure I got there, but it makes sense to
coded, I would assume.
This was something we hadn't discussed before as a committee, and it just appeared when it came back from the drafter, which was a new drafter, and I'm not familiar at all with what the issue is here.
Yeah. Representative Burns? Excuse me. The employment program is defined in that statute. Are you familiar with that definition?
I just read the 3630. I've got it right here.
Okay.
In fact, this new language is in the supplement.
Here's a copy of the statute. It should be in your committee file for supplement. It should be in the collection.
Good, it's here. It's in packet. Maybe set something.
I've got no idea why they put this in here. I'm not familiar with this type of employment program.
Well, I would assume here, we're talking state contracts, and it appears here that if a contract was left to carry out a particular function, and if that function could be equated into a sort of a jobs type program, kind of commerce and economic development, occasionally there are business development type grants, contracts left, whereby people will do loan packaging. If that can be used as a training for people, it appears that a person who had a training component included in their bid proposal that they would get the 10% preference.
And it also adds that the other provisions would apply too if it was a small event.
So it looks like there may be an additional percentage in there. Again, it's a
my name is Bob Link. I'm the Director of Division of General Services Supply.
Mr. Link, first of all, do you have any idea how this got into our
bill? I haven't seen the work draft. I just came over to be here at 3, and I walked in, and the clock was on some sort of savings time. Anyway, I just heard you talking about the what happened. There's a sort of weird thing going on with the bills becoming effective at different times. So I think what happened is the person who drafted 45 took whatever was drafted last year to change the preferences, and just made them applicable to the part of the statute which is going to be effective on July 1st. 37 is in effect right now and becomes ineffective on July 1st. Then 3630 becomes effective. So what happened is you had this law taking place on July 1st. You got the existing law now. Most of this is what would have changed the existing law. And in the meanwhile, when they built 3630. They took a lot of this type of input on the subject of bidder's preference, and they changed 3630 to react to a lot of people's concerns. So that's why there's paragraphs in some and out of some, and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So you have this sort of strange circumstance right now where everybody's trying to fix 37, but fixing 37 doesn't make it the way it will be. Fixing 36 is a little bit different. So anyway,
okay.
So anyway, the employment program part was originally addressed in Title 37. They're called sheltered workshops. And sheltered workshops are generally, there's a couple of agencies. I think there's ARCA in Anchorage, and something called ETCA, which is Employment Training Center of Alaska. And there's several around the state. And those folks made a case that they're providing work for the mentally and physically handicapped. And they have, because of that, they operate not as efficiently. They operate labor intensively and not necessarily as efficiently as people who have all their facilities. So they made a case that they ought to get an additional preference when they did over regular businesses, and they were given that.
So they get an additional 10%.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But now,
so that's where that came from.
Let me get this straight. This, I thought this paragraph, and since we didn't ask for it, this is pretty new to us, is simply rolling these people into the existing formula in the bill.
Right. In line with the update from 86, that's in the supplement there, so yeah, that's what it is.
finished doing.
Okay.
Which is a problem.
All right.
All right. The other guy didn't see that.
Okay. Well, there's a couple.
I have my Yukon question again. The Yukon government people who were here, and one of the things they found that worked, which was constitutionally feasible, was to put in a value-added requirement in their bid document. That is one way of gaining points. Representative Boucher pointed out there's some 1,800 small manufacturers in the state. I have one who manufactured Swedish type windows in my district, and I know somebody who makes mattresses of all things in Fairbanks. And what the Yukon essentially does is give an additional point for the use of materials or partial building part manufacturing.
The procurement bill, which becomes effective in July 1st, contains a value-added preference for Alaskan manufactured materials. It's a sliding preference based on the amount of value which is added in-state. It's not in effect now, but it starts July 1st.
And along those same lines,
we got so long, I don't know if it's that long.
Section 2 of the committee substitute before you has... and the section 3 right below it where it says in addition to, that was a question by the committee posed in the last hearing on this bill to make that language a little more understandable, how it relates to the new procurement. So that change is also made. Mr. Link, did you have any specific further comments? Don't feel obliged to, but...
Oh, okay, no, only one, and that was the... Let me reread number 2. I comment on number 2 because my commissioners expressed a little interest in that because it wasn't sure exactly what the intent was with number 2.
Mr. Link, your comments addressed the drafting, the language, how it's structured there.
Yeah,
because we do have another alternative proposal.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't sure what the intent was. I was going to say, this is one of the ones people always have a hassle over, is defining what a real Alaskan business is. And I've listened to this similar types of bills come up, and it seems usually where it gets stuck. But I'm not exactly sure what the direction is you're trying to hit with number 2. But I'm glad to provide any help I can.
As regards to section 3, page 1 of the bill, possibly a better alternative, and I will throw this out to the committee members, it's also an alternative that's been suggested by the drafters, would be to delete, notwithstanding an Alaskan product preference under AS 363322 through 338, and capitalize the T and the, say, procurement officer shall award a contract based on solicited bids to the lowest responsible and responsive Alaska bidder if the bid, comma, after the Alaska product preference under AS 363322 through 338, if applicable, is not more than. And that's one of the alternatives the drafters have sent us. That might have just, I think, at first you raised a concern that language was a little confusing last time.
Yeah, that sounds okay. But you're reading off of the original draft now, aren't you?
Right, and we do we just had two proposals here I wanted to throw out to the committee. I think that...
I clarify that.
Yeah, I think that addresses the concern you raised. Would somebody move that language and we can roll that into a new committee substitute? Any objection?
Or whatever. Unanimous consent.
Yeah. Now, there's only one other change that this proposal does, and that's the change on line on page 2, section 6, line 22, where the difference used to be 20%. The requirement was 20% of the businesses or the person's annual business was in the state. That's been up to 50% by a suggestion of the Department of Commerce. That was their testimony at the last hearing we had. Is there a motion to
approve? So we'll ask unanimous consent, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection. So then, and then the other thing we did was we deleted the residence hire language, which caused the Attorney General's office specific concern. That was in the original bill, required that anybody obtaining the product preference had to hire only Alaskans or have a resident hire policy. And by deleting that, I think we've avoided a lot of constitutional problems with overbreath, reaching too far into the private sector. We have a consensus among the committee that that's okay. Without objection. And those pretty much run through the...